to begin just by reminding everyone of the overview of Genesis that we looked at Sunday, the outline of the book, two basic parts to the book. The first 11 chapters are an introduction of sorts to the book, primeval history, early history of mankind, and then the second half of the book, the main section of the book, the patriarchal history, the account of God's dealings with Abraham and Jacob and Joseph. But we want to focus our attention here tonight on the very beginning chapter, this prologue, which is, as I said, this introduction really to this primeval history. So starting everything out here in Genesis 1, giving an account of the creation of all things. And I think it's probably good to ignore the chapter division here. Really, this prologue, this account of creation, extends down to chapter 2, verse 4, at least the first half of verse 4. So this is the material that we want to look at tonight. And I want us to start with this question. Why does the book begin with this creation account? Why does the book begin with this creation account? Okay, is that the purpose of Genesis? Just to give the history of the world? No, that's really not the purpose of Genesis, is it? So in light of the purpose of Genesis, why do you think Moses begins with this creation account? Scotty? Okay, I don't think there's any question about that, that this is a account that just so impresses you with God's power, how he commands things to come into existence. And put this in historical context. And we talked a little bit about this Sunday, that when we read Genesis, we need to remember this was not written to us initially, was it? It was written initially by Moses, by the inspiration of God for the Israelite people, and then it was put then in, as the first book in this entire Old Testament canon of books for the nation of Israel throughout their history. So as far as their particular needs, why do you think Genesis would begin with this account of creation? Okay, I think that's just exactly right. Did everyone hear what Pat said? Okay, some people didn't hear what Pat said. Well, it was a great point. I sure wish you could have heard it. Repeat that and just say it a little bit louder.
You've got a mic
on. Well, I won't say it as well as you do.
I was just saying that the reason is he's introducing God to the Israelites, and he's trying to compare the gods that other people, nations were serving with the true God.
Doesn't that make a lot of sense? When you think about Moses now writing this in the wilderness for the Israelites as they've come out of Egyptian bondage, and it's very obvious when you look at what the book of Exodus later would tell us, that when the Israelites come out of Egyptian bondage, they don't have a whole lot of knowledge about the God of their ancestors. So, in fact, even when they come to Mount Sinai, God has to introduce himself, so to speak, to the people. And that's really what Moses is doing here. He's introducing the people of Israel to their God, Yahweh, and explaining that he is not just a God. He's not just the God of Israel, but he is the God of gods. He is the creator of all things. And therefore, he ultimately is the Lord of heaven and earth because he made them. And in their context, what is the major, major false doctrine that the Israelites and all the people of the world at that time had been taught? Polytheism. Everyone agree with me in that statement that that would have been the major false doctrine? I mean, just the most fundamental doctrine of the nature of deity, the nature of God, and the relationship of deity to creation. the world round about them is a thoroughly polytheistic world. By the time Moses writes Genesis, mankind has lost a knowledge of the Creator. They don't know who Yahweh is anymore. And they worship all these gods, and nobody even knows who Yahweh is. So that's how we have to understand what Moses is doing here. As he is writing this, he is writing this to show, listen, here's how the world began. And this God spoke all things into existence. And everything that we see was made by him. And it's not the way that your polytheistic world has taught you with its myths and its legends and all these false accounts. Those are not true. Here's the truth of what happened. And I think we need to put it in that context. So I want to just real quickly take about 5 minutes to talk with you about what the people in Moses' day were taught about the beginning of all things. You see why we need to think about that? Because that's the context in which Genesis was written. Genesis is attacking these false views that were so prevalent in the ancient world. Now, just real quickly, let me just inform you about some of the sources of the mythologies of the ancient world. Enuma Elish, this is a Mesopotamian document that contains the typical legend in that ancient world of how things were at the very beginning. And basically, it's a legend that talks about how heaven and earth always existed, and heaven and earth are personified, and heaven and earth mate and create all that's in the world. How's that for a mythology, a mythological account of how all things began? But that's what so many people in the ancient world believed. This is a 15th century BC tablet containing the Gilgamesh epic. Everybody in the second millennium BC knew about the Gilgamesh epic. It was like a standard story just throughout Mesopotamia. It was the classic tale. Kind of like how in the Greek period and the Roman period, Homer's Odyssey or Homer's Iliad would just be a classic tale that everybody knew. This was the Epic of Gilgamesh. And it contains an account of primeval history, about how the gods formed the world, how the gods were created, how heaven and earth were separated, and then how human beings were formed by certain gods and why they formed them. This is the 11th tablet of the Assyrian version of the Gilgamesh epic. It contains a flood account that is part of this legend, this mythology that the ancient world had as they had sort of mythologized those distant memories of that worldwide flood. And so as we read the opening chapters of Genesis, Genesis 1 through 11, I think it's so important that we understand is that Moses is writing all this to set the record straight and to teach the people of his day, even the Israelites, who frankly have been brought up in a polytheistic environment and they're polytheistic in their thinking, to teach them the truth about what really happened and about who their God really is. Just real quickly, Atrahasis, ancient creation myth. It's in poetry form. You are the birth goddess, creatress of mankind. Create Lulu, that's their word for human being, that he may bear the yoke. Let him bear the yoke assigned by Enlil, one of the gods. Let man carry the toil of the gods. In the ancient myths about primeval history, human beings were created by the gods in order to work and toil to provide the gods with food and provide the gods with their needs. Do you begin to see how significant then Genesis 1 is when it begins to explain how things really happened and how man really was created and why man was created? Not because Yahweh needed a slave to provide for him. But that's the way it was understood in the ancient Near Eastern myths. You see this throughout the ancient Near Eastern world. Let me just give you one other example. In the Gilgamesh epic, when heaven had been moved away from the earth, when earth had been separated from heaven, like that's a common theme in these ancient mythologies, where heaven and earth and the beings of heaven and the beings of earth originally were united and then they were separated, great gulf between them. Okay, when that happened, when the name of man had been fixed, when An had carried off heaven, when Enlil had carried off earth, and so it goes on to talk about how there's this separation between all the gods and then human beings down below, and then it goes on to talk about how the human beings begin to multiply and become very numerous and very noisy, and some of the gods don't like it. They can't get enough sleep. And so one of the gods, who's a real meanie god, he says, let's just wipe them out. And so he sends the flood. And another god rescues one family in a great big boat. I mean, folks, these ancient mythologies reflect, you know, some distant memory in humanity of the truth. But it had been so perverted and so corrupted and so turned into a polytheistic concept. And that's what Moses is setting straight when he starts out the book of Genesis in this way. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. Right off the bat, do you see the significance of that verse in the original context of Israel and this polytheistic world and all of their polytheistic myths? You see the impact of that verse? It's not in the beginning gods, plural, formed heaven and earth. It's one God. And as Moses keeps going, that one God is this God Yahweh. He'll use the name Yahweh when he gets into chapter 2. Yahweh, that personal name of Israel's God. And so it's this one God who made heaven and earth. And in so many of the ancient mythologies, heaven and earth are viewed as gods themselves. And heaven mates with Mother Earth. And that's what produces all the vegetation and all the life. And that was their mythology. Yet look at what Moses is indicating. No, heaven and earth are not gods. And they don't mate to bring all things into existence. Heaven and earth are simply this material world. And they're part of what God made. They are what God created in the very beginning. So, just a complete refutation of the paganism of the ancient world, setting the record straight. Dwayne? Could have been written, could have been oral, just oral tradition, you know, traditional stories and folk tales that begin to arise. I mean, maybe something written down too. I mean, we don't know. But I think the main point is what you just said, how it, whatever was passed down from generation to generation just gets corrupted and mythologized and, you know, all this erroneous stuff is attached to it. All right, let's talk about the terminology a little bit further here, because I think this is important for people to appreciate, not just Genesis, but the rest of the Old Testament. What's the word heavens mean? Might sound like a stupid question. Oh, we all know what that means. Yeah, what did the Hebrew word mean? The Hebrew word just meant the heights. What's up there? In fact, what's very important, if you want to really understand the terminology here in Genesis, you need to make sure that you are just thinking about it from the perspective of Moses and the Israelites. Go outside and look up. That's the heavens. What's up there? The term earth. Does the term earth in the Bible, is that equivalent to our term planet earth? No, it's the Hebrew word eretz is just a word that means land, ground. Okay? So, in the beginning, God made what's up there, and God made what's down here, the earth. That will be the common way throughout the Bible that creation is conceived of. The two parts of creation. The heavens, the earth. What's up there, what's down here. Okay? And that frustrates a lot of people. Because a lot of people in our day and time, you know, we want to read these Bible passages as passages that are talking about, you know, a whole bunch of stuff from a scientific point of view that, you know, well, I mean, it includes all that, but it's certainly not discussing that. You know, it's just making the point, the totality of creation, what's up there, everything that would be up there, and then what's down here, God made that. And so it's not getting more specific than that. And, you know, I've had people try to interpret this as like planet, earth, globe, and that's not what the word means. The earth was formless and void, and the darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. So now think about that. Imagine what that's talking about. Originally, when God initially made the heavens and the earth, what was covering the earth? All this water. The deep. And there was no light. It's absolutely dark. Can you imagine that? Try to envision that. I mean, we just can't even really almost imagine that. But darkness was over the surface of the deep. And it says the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. Some of your versions may say the wind of God or the breath of God, because you could translate the Hebrew that way. But the point is, if you've got the earth in this initial state of existence that is covered over by water, and everything is in complete darkness, is that a habitable place for man? No, it's formless and void. There's nothing there. It hasn't yet been formed. It's just initial state, and then now what God is going to do, Moses says, in these 6 days of creation, he's going to now form this and put things in the heavens and the earth so that this creation will be a habitable place for man. His prime creation. Okay. And notice as we go through this that everything that comes into existence, everything that is formed, and everything that makes the heavens and the earth a habitable place for man is all created at the command of God. He speaks and it's done. And so there's no other God. There's not some God of the ocean and God of the earth or God of the vegetation or God of the sun. No, none of that. Everything that is formed is simply the creation of this one God who made everything. That's the overall message here. Comments, questions? Yeah, Mickey.
Is the surface of the deep and the surface of the waters the same thing?
Yeah, deep refers to the waters, the word in the origin. Yeah, like what we would think of as the ocean waters, except here the oceans are covering everything, you know, all the earth. So darkness was over the surface of the deep. Somebody else, I think, raised a hand. I thought I saw a hand. Okay. So then, let's just read this account of creation and Do you notice how orderly and structured this account is? You know, very orderly and structured, which attests to the fact that this is a very orderly and structured universe that God makes. And the account of it is very, there's a set pattern about everything. So let's just read it. Then God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, one day. So there was complete darkness originally, and so now what does God do on this first day of creation? He commands that light would exist, and light obeys and comes into existence. And so, just as we think of a day that you have evening and then the next morning, well, you had a time of darkness, you have light now, a time of light. And so he says there was evening, there was morning, one day. So just imagine this. There's no sun yet, but he says, "Let there be light," and there is light. Now, you know, people, from our vantage point, we want to ask a whole bunch of questions, you know. Okay, well, how did God, you know, what's the molecular quality of the light and the, you know, the light waves without the sun, and how did God do that, you know? And, of course, the answer to that question is, we don't know. That's not what Genesis is trying to explain. But God in his power did that. And that's what Moses is trying to emphasize. All right, verse 6. You've got the second day talked about. Then God said, "Let there be an expanse," my version says, your version might say firmament, "in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." God made the expanse and separated the waters which were below the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse, and it was so. God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening and there was morning a second day. This word expanse or firmament that separates the waters down below from the waters up above. Well, you know, it just seems to me, and when you look at the term, it's just talking about the sky, and it's talking about that God, you know, these waters that were totally covering the earth, well, he made this separation here. So, in fact, as we live on the earth now, don't we observe that there's water down here below on the earthly level, and yet there's also water up there that comes down in the rainfall? Well, that's what he's talking about. He doesn't go into some scientific explanation of all this, you know. The scientists in the audience, you know, would sure wish that Moses would have done that, or God would have had Moses do it, but that's not what the text is, that's not what its purpose is. But this is what God did, Moses said. This is the truth of the matter. So you have this firmament, this expanse, and it separates the waters down below from the waters above. Okay. But the waters down below still cover the earth. I mean, the earth is still covered. Still enough water down below for it to be covered. And so you got day three. So let's look at this. Verse 9. Then God said, "Let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the gathering of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees on the earth, bearing fruit after their kind with seed in them." And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind, and trees bearing fruit with seed in them after their kind. And God saw that it was good. So what did God do on day three? How would you summarize it? Seems to me he did two major things. What are they?
He
Okay? He made the dry land appear by having the water that was still sufficient to cover the earth to recede, so that I think we would say the continents are poking up out of the ocean waters. And so that's what we see now, is that the ocean waters come up so far onto the dry land, the continents. You know, the tides come in, but only so far. And so that's because God had the water gathered to this one place so the dry land would appear. What's the second thing that he did here on day three? He commanded the earth to sprout forth vegetation. And the earth obeys and sprouts vegetation. Do you see how everything that God does, he accomplishes just by giving his command? Isn't that interesting? You know, in these ancient Near Eastern accounts, the gods are, you know, they're mating in order to produce something, or they're building something, like a building or this or that, like human beings have to, with their own hands, do manual labor or that kind of thing. Not this God. He's a great king. And great kings just give their orders. And so this great king commands that all these things that don't exist come into existence, and these things obey and do exactly what he says. He commands the earth to sprout vegetation, and it obeys. And there's the account of how everything happens exactly as God had said for it to happen. So there is great power here. He's a great king. He's an authoritative God who has an authoritative word. When God speaks, his creation obeys. Can you think of what the lesson would be for Israel? What's the lesson for Israel? When God, remember, Moses writes this when Israel has come out of Egypt to Mount Sinai to get the law, God's word to them. So look at how everything's starting out. Moses is reminding them or informing them, this is a God who issues commands and expects his creation to obey him. And if that was true with the initial creation, who is Israel to think that they can have God speak to them and they just ignore him? You see the point in all this? It's really powerful. It's teaching a very powerful lesson. Dwayne? Just like it does in English? Sure. I think the Israelites would have clearly thought of that as exactly what we mean by an evening and a morning and a day. I mean, that's just what that language means, you know. So I think that would be the natural way to take it if that's what you're asking.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah. A second day. Yeah, yeah. The first one day is the, I always get these terms mixed up. I think the one day is an ordinal number one, but then the other numbers are cardinal numbers. Yeah, yeah. But I don't know there's any real significance to the distinction there. It just seems to me he's enumerating these days. Here's what God did each of these 6 days. Seems to me. Okay. Now, when we look at the next 3 days, I think it will be interesting if you realize that what God makes now on days 4, 5, and 6 corresponds to what he made on days 1, 2, and 3. So let's look at day 4 here. Verse 14. Then God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons, and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth." And it was so. God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, and the lesser light to govern the night. He made the stars also. God placed them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth and to govern the day and the night and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. There was evening and there was morning, a fourth day. And so what did God make on day four? Well, the sun, the moon, the stars, the light bearers. Okay. On day one, he made light. But now he makes these bodies that are luminous bodies that are going to give light upon the earth. And what's the other purpose, he says, that these heavenly light sources are going to provide? Govern the seasons. In other words, measuring time. To enable man to measure the passing of time. That's what all this is about. Now, something very, very interesting about this. In the ancient pagan world, how did they view these heavenly bodies? The sun, the moon, the stars. As gods to be worshipped. The Israelites had just come out of Egypt. Who was the chief Egyptian god of their pantheon? Ra, god of the sun. And yet Moses is very calmly explaining here, these are not deities. There is one God. These are all parts of God's creation. And they came into existence at God's behest and for no other reason. And they performed the purpose that God gave them to perform and no other function. That is an implicit attack against polytheism. I mean, the ancient Israelites would not have missed that. I mean, no one would have missed that. All right, let's look then at day 5, verse 20. Then God said, let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heavens. God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves with which the waters swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas and let birds multiply on the earth. There was evening and there was morning, a fifth day. So what does God make on day 5? A couple of things. Birds to fly in the firmament, the expanse, or the sky, as we've used the term. And then let all sorts of fish and marine life team in the seas. Everyone see how that corresponds with the habitat that God created on day 2? On day 2, he separated the waters from waters by means of the sky, and you've got birds flying in the sky, and now fish and marine life of all kinds in the ocean waters. Yeah. Yeah, well, okay, that's a term. The term is related to the term Leviathan. That was their Hebrew word for all those big, big, awesome, scary creatures out there in the ocean. Sea monsters might, to us, that translation might make it sound fictitious or something. No, it's just their term for... Yeah, whales, I think, could be included, but just whatever's out there, you know. Again, in the ancient pagan world, so often those creatures were deified, or they're used as symbols for gods, for demons. And yet again, what you're seeing is, no, these are just part of God's creation. Okay. Other question, comment? All right. Day 6, verse 24. Then God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after their kind. And it was so. God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps on the ground after its kind. And God saw that it was good. Okay, now that's only part of what he does here on day six, but he's making land animals. Okay. And now what he's going to go on to talk about is the creation of man, the prime creation, the ultimate creation of God. Before we get to that, does everyone see now the orderly way in which Moses said God created and formed this formless heaven and earth, this void, this wasteland? He formed it so it would be a fit habitat for man. And he did it by, in the first 3 days, creating what we might call the habitats, and then the latter 3 days, creating those things that would go in those respective habitats. So there's this correspondence to everything. Very orderly, very much like the wise sage in Proverbs. The first 9 chapters of Proverbs talks about how in the very beginning, God made everything by means of wisdom. Wisdom was with him in the beginning. And you just see that illustrated. You know, this is no haphazard creation. It's a very orderly, very, very structured thing that God did. All right, let's then look at the creation of man. And this is, of course, the ultimate creation that gets all the emphasis. Verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth." Then God said, "Behold, I've given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has fruit yielding seed. It shall be food for you. And to every beast of the earth, and every bird of the sky, and to everything that moves on the earth, which has life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. So let's just pause there. All right, now, look at what the text says that God did. First of all, you have to ask this question about the "let us make man." This expression, "let us do something," is found here in Genesis 1:26. It's also found over in Genesis 3:22 and also over in chapter 11 and verse 7, where when God is doing something, he uses this expression, "let us do such and such." And so you have the obvious question, what exactly is that? Some have suggested that that's a reference to the Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. I don't doubt that you can read it that way. I don't think that's what Moses would have been saying to the Israelites in their context. There wasn't some teaching of the Trinity that was made. So I doubt that really is it, but some people say that. It's very possible that he's speaking to the angels, "Let us make man in our spiritual image," because God and angels do share this spiritual, non-physical body, non-physical soul or a spirit rather. And so it's possible that he means that. Or another possibility that to me makes a lot of sense is that it's really just sort of a rhetorical way of a great king talking, a plural of majesty. In fact, even the word for God throughout Genesis 1, the word Elohim, it's plural in the Hebrew. Now, it's used to refer to a singular being, but it's plural in grammatical number. It's a plural of majesty, because he's the ultimate God. So maybe this expression "let us" is indicating that same thing. You know, you can talk about that and debate about that. But the main point that's being made is he's saying, let's make man and make him in the image of God. And that's what the text says God does. Yeah, Mickey.
It doesn't seem like it could possibly be the angels, because the angels didn't have anything to do with creating. So if you say, let us make man in our image, that would indicate that the angels would have something to do with it.
You would think. That's kind of what makes me lean toward the third view, that it's just this plural of majesty. You know, so, yeah. Okay. Well, you're right. You're kind of jumping ahead a little bit. I will talk about that further when we get to Noah and the flood, but the point you're making is right. The word kind here, it isn't equivalent to our modern word species. It's a much more general term. Just different kinds of animals that reproduce after their own kind. And the obvious thing that we observe animals when they reproduce, well, that's what the Hebrew word was referring to. So, yeah. Ralph? Well, that's that Trinity view, that first view that is talking about Father and the Son, the Holy Spirit. And I mean, maybe, you know, I'm reluctant to think that, because to me that doesn't really fit with what the Old Testament ever presents and what Moses would have been presenting to Israel. It just, you know, but I mean, it certainly fits in with that idea that God made everything by means of the Son. You know, the book of Hebrews talks about that. So I'm not saying, that's why I had it on the chart. I think it's a possibility. It just, to me, is not as likely. But again, I mean, I may be dead wrong in that. Okay, the main point in all this, though, is what's true about human beings. What's the main point he's making? Made in the image of God, and they're made to rule over everything. In the ancient world, that's kingship language. God is having man be the ruler of his creation. Now, as a vice regent to God, you know. But I mean, the idea here is that man is ruling over God's world on his behalf. And so all these creatures on the earth, man has dominion over. And so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Okay, Isaac?
A lot of people today struggle with the deity, you know, the three-way deity. How focused were the Jews on a plurality deity? I mean, they were aware of the Spirit of God, but they see that as a second entity?
Nope.
I mean, they didn't know about Jesus. So how did the Jews...
That's what I'm saying is, I don't really think that Trinity explanation makes a lot of sense, because there's nowhere in the Old Testament that that's ever brought out, or any kind of... I think what people think of when they think of Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, that's just not brought out in the Old Testament.
Well, did the Jews have seen Jehovah, one God, period?
Yeah, sure.
Always?
Yeah, now, he manifests himself, you know, in different ways, but yeah, I mean, he's... Yeah, one God.
Would they have seen his Spirit as a second entity?
No, that's just how he operates. I mean, this is part of the... In fact, I don't want to, here in the last 5 minutes, get off on all this that's going to take us on a rabbit chase. This is what bothers me by the term Trinity. and whatever people think by Trinity, I think it kind of comes more from Catholicism doctrine. And I think people kind of have this idea of three personalities, three gods somehow. And that's just not biblical. Now, the Bible talks about Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Don't misunderstand me. But I think sometimes what people get in their minds is almost a polytheistic concept, which is not at all what the Bible's presenting. So it's different ways that this one God manifests himself. Andrea?
That's true what you're saying, because coming from that kind of background, the three, all three, the same background.
Yeah, as if they're three different, like Isaac's question, in the Old Testament, when the text refers to God and then the Spirit of God, would the Israelites have understood that as somehow two different personalities that make up a dyune being? You know? No, I mean, that's not how they would have thought of that.
Would you say Elohim suggests plurality?
Well, it's a plural of majesty. It's just the word in its grammatical form is in the plural, but it's in the plural referring to a singular being to talk about how full he is, how majestic he is, how great he is. And so that may be the same sense behind the idiom, let us make man, let us do this. You know? That we aren't... Folks, if you get bogged down as you read Genesis 1 or any part of Genesis with a question like that that we really can't answer, you're going to miss what really is there. So I don't want us to do that. I don't mean to imply that it's not a good question. I know it's a very good question. But at the end of the day, we're going to have to say we don't really know. But for goodness sakes, appreciate what really is being talked about here and what's being emphasized. Mickey?
But John 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. There was a plurality, and Christ was the Word, which was made flesh and dwelt among us. So there was a plurality in the beginning.
Sure.
When God made them.
Sure. I mean, that's there's no question about that.
I mean, they didn't understand that with this.
That's right. The question is that what this passage was trying to reveal?
No.
I don't think it was. Now, maybe it was, but I don't think that that's really what Moses was intending to do.
John 1 explains this.
Well, you could say that this was something that the Old Testament purposely left vague, and then it took the New Testament to explain it. The problem that I would have with that is it's not just used in this creation passage. It's also used over in chapter 11 in a context that has nothing to do with this. And you wonder why it's not used throughout the rest of the Old Testament then. But maybe you're right. You know, that's certainly a possibility, which is why I put it on the chart. Okay. Was that the second bell? Okay. Next time we're going to get into chapter 2. And I hope that you've already read at least up through chapter 4, but I really hope you'll continue to keep reading at least up through chapter 11. I'd like you to get the whole primeval history in your mind. I think that'd be really helpful. Okay, thank you for your good comments.